It's Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferris. If you're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear about the Clean Hop Project, a program exploring the possibility of growing certain kinds of hops here in Wisconsin for the state's craft beer industry.
First, Governor Walker announced the proposed state budget for 2017 through 2019 last week. Among the changes being floated is more state funding for schools, a shift to self-insurance for state employees, and more.
Details are still emerging in the budget as a whole, including changes that might come for commissions that oversee certain parts of the governmental process, some of which could be dissolved under the new budget.
Laurel White joins us now to talk about what the future could hold for these committees. She's the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Laurel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What commissions could be disbanded under Governor Walker's budget plan?
Well, you know, there are several things that the governor has proposed eliminating or cutting back in his 2017-2019 budget proposal. I focused on three of those for a story I did for WPR yesterday, and those are the Labor and Industry Review Commission, the Judicial Commission, and the Educational Approval Board.
Let's start with the Labor and Industry Review Commission. What does this commission do, and what is the argument for dismantling it?
So the Labor and Industry Review Commission, known by insiders as LIRC, is a three-person body that resolves disputes that involve things like unemployment insurance, workers' compensation, or other employment issues. So if an employee has a grievance with their employer that has to do with one of those things, they go before what's called an administrative law judge. Who are specialized judges that hear these kind of cases. If they don't like the decision of the administrative law judge, they can appeal that to LIRC, this labor commission. So what the governor is proposing is eliminating this commission that hears those appeals and shifting all of its responsibilities to two different state agencies, the Department of Administration and the Department of Workforce Development.
So other agencies would absorb what LIRC is doing.
That's right. That's right. So basically what the governor is saying here is that he's creating more efficiency. He's eliminating a redundancy and sort of streamlining the process, because the two state agencies that would absorb these cases from LIRC already hear some labor disputes and other workplace disputes. So he's saying that they can just absorb the LIRC cases easily.
And another proposal you looked at was eliminating the Educational Approval Board. What does this commission do?
Well, the Educational Approval Board is the body that regulates for-profit colleges and universities in Wisconsin. So they essentially, you know, they don't oversee the UW system, but they oversee those for-profit, you know, Globe University, IIT was a institution that was actually disbanded last year.
Yeah.
So they're in charge of regulating those.
And so what would happen if this board would go away?
So this is really similar to what the governor proposed for that labor commission. He wants to essentially shift the responsibilities for the Educational Approval Board to another state agency. He wants to shift all the regulation of these for-profit institutions to the Department of Safety and Professional Services.
And what are the arguments for keeping this board intact, for maintaining the commission?
Well, I spoke with the executive secretary of the Educational Approval Board yesterday, and he said the strongest argument for keeping the board as it is the expertise that board members have. So there are seven different board members in this body, and a lot of them have experience in education. They were former administrators. And he says if things were shifted to the Department of Safety and Professional Services, there might not necessarily be that institutional knowledge, that expertise there.
Mm-hmm.
He actually did say, though, that there could be a benefit to shifting the responsibilities to the Department of Safety and Professional Services. He says that department has many more resources. It's obviously a lot larger. And would have things like in-house counsel that could benefit some of this regulation. So he says that board is meeting later this week to decide whether they support, oppose, or are neutral on the governor's proposal to sort of eliminate it.
And what could happen to the Judicial Commission under Governor Walker's budget proposal?
So the Judicial Commission is very different from the other two things that we just discussed. So the Judicial Commission would not go away. Its responsibilities would not be absorbed by something else. It's just transferred. So and in kind of a financial way. So the commission stays the same, but its budget is just going to come from the state Supreme Court budget now under the governor's proposal.
We're talking with Laurel White. She's state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News, talking to us about some commissions that would be under Governor Walker's budget proposal that would be eliminated. And Laurel, is there something to be said about the benefits of removing these commissions? Governor Walker has talked about streamlining the government.
Yeah, so that's really the governor's primary argument here. You know, a statement from his office yesterday said, this budget identifies redundancies and institutes reform where we believe it makes sense. Some of the pushback on these things say, you know, the work wouldn't be absorbed well, or it wouldn't be done as well, or as I just mentioned, some expertise might go away. But the governor's office really pushes back on that and says that he's just kind of removing unnecessary, he would say, layers of government.
Do we know if there is a cost savings here for doing these things?
So for the Judicial Commission, there wouldn't be any cost savings there. It's just shifting over. For the Labor and Industry Review Commission, shifting that over into those two other state departments would actually come with the elimination of 26 jobs that are currently underneath the Labor Commission. So the governor projects that that would save about $3.2 million over the biennium. So there are some savings there. There would not be any savings with the Educational Approval Board, because interestingly, that board is funded entirely by fees from the schools, the for-profit schools that it regulates.
And what have you heard from lawmakers about the potential to end these commissions?
Well, two of these proposals, the change to the Judicial Commission and the elimination of the Educational Approval Board, were actually things that the governor presented in his last biennial budget, the biennial budget for 2015 to 2017.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And those were both rejected by state lawmakers. They didn't think it was necessary or proper. So there's certainly the opportunity this time around as well for state lawmakers to review these proposals by the governor and decide that they're not worth the, you know, the logistics of transferring them over.
Yeah. What do you think is the sticking point here with these proposals? What's holding them up?
Well, I think with the Judicial Commission, this one got some pretty high-profile pushback. This is the one that would, you know, move the budget under the state Supreme Court. There was actually a state Supreme Court justice, Annette Ziegler, who came out last time and was vocal that it wasn't appropriate for the budget for this commission to be underneath the state Supreme Court because it created sort of a perception that the court was controlling this commission. And the commission is in charge of policing judicial ethics and would be in charge of any complaints against Supreme Court justices themselves. So she said it seemed kind of improper for a watchdog to be under the control of something that it's watchdogging. So that could be a sticking point with the Judicial Commission. The Educational Approval Board, lawmakers, you know, there hasn't been as much vocal pushback to this, but they might cite the argument about experience in current board members. They might say, you know, this doesn't save us any money, so we don't need to go through the logistics of the switch. We'll just have to wait and see. You know, the budget hearings are going to start within the next couple weeks, and these arguments will start to bubble up a little bit more.
Laurel, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Laurel White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. She joined us to talk about what could be in store for some state committees under Wisconsin's proposed 2017 through 2019 budget.
Right now, hops, those little cone-like flowers that give beer its signature flavor. Most hops in the U.S. are grown in the Pacific Northwest and the panhandle of Idaho.
So what do Wisconsin breweries do if they want to use all local ingredients? Our next guest is hoping to help out with that.
Jerry Clark joins us now. He's an agriculture agent at UW Extension in Chippewa County. He's here to tell us about a hop-growing study in Wisconsin. It's called the Clean Hop Project. Jerry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rob.
We'll spend a lot of time on the supply side and how we grow these, Jerry. Let's start on the demand side. Hops, talk about the role they play in making beer.
Well, hops are for the flavor, so that's usually the bittering that will occur within the beer fermentation process. So depending on the variety that you're going to be using, as well as how long that fermentation process will take, those are all part of the craft beer and the brewmaster's secret ingredients, so to speak. But each hop variety provides a different flavor, and whatever you select for that, select a hop for a specific flavor, or depending how long that hop is in the mash or within the fermentation process, that will determine the flavor of most beers.
I haven't been on top of craft beer trends as much as I used to, but where I left off, there was a lot of hops going on. There were some really hoppy beers out there, right?
Right, yes, and that's where the IPAs are typically the higher, the more bittering units you have in a beer. The IPAs typically are on the higher end. And so there's a history there that in order to ship beer from Europe to India, of course, IPA is for Indian Pale Ale to the country of India, they had to have a very high bittering unit in order for the beer to stay bitter, in order to make it in transportation through the shipping channels all the way to India. So the bittering units are very high in IPAs. So all the different types of beers that we have, whether it's a porter, a stout, depending on what they're making, a pilsner, these types of beers, it all depends on the hop is what's going to drive that, the bittering and the flavor.
And a lot of these craft beer producers, I imagine, here in Wisconsin are trying to be as locally sourced as possible, but hops, that's a stumbling block right now.
Yeah, Wisconsin was historically a high producing state for hops. About 100 years ago, it started to leave the state, and that was all due to downy mildew, which is the one disease that we're still battling. We have some better fungicides for it, but downy mildew is basically the disease that drove the hop industry out of Wisconsin. So as craft beer started to come back, and the craft brewers were looking for all local ingredients, we started to see an interest back in hops, and I think currently we're up around some of the surveys we've done recently are up around 300 to 500 acres statewide, depending. It's probably closer to 300 to 400 acres, but increasing. So as people add a few acres every year, we're seeing the amount of hops that are being grown in the state continuing to climb.
Well, let's get into this Clean Hop Project. What's happening there?
Well, the Clean Hop Project is basically something that started, again, demand from starting to grow hops locally here in Wisconsin. And then it's a collaboration with the University of Wisconsin-Madison, especially the plant pathology department and some of the local agents in UW Extension, primarily in Buffalo County with Carl Dooley, and then down in Tim Rabine was down in Vernon County, who recently retired, and myself. We've been kind of working on helping this project along, but it's really driven by the University of Madison plant pathology department. But basically, it's hard to get pathogen-free plant material for growers to plant into their new hop yards. So basically, this program was driven for four goals in mind, was to evaluate hop varieties that are high-yielding and have good quality that can be adapted to Wisconsin, and then develop an economically sustainable system for producing the pathogen-free planting stock. And that's where the plant pathology department at UW-Madison has been doing some tissue culture as well as standard propagation, trying to get basically disease-free planting material that Wisconsin producers can use in order to start out clean and not have downy mildew or some of these other viruses that can be infecting the material. When you order it online or get it from out of state, you could be bringing in some problems that are already in the planting material. That be the actual plant itself, some small plantlets, or you end up with purchasing rhizomes. There can be diseases harbored within that plant material. So what the plant pathology department at UW-Madison has been doing is culturing a number of plants and indexing through propagation and tissue culture, and determining or producing some plant material that is free of diseases. So it's a nice, clean, and that's why we call it the Clean Hop Program. Has a clean, there's no diseases in it. Producers or hop yard owners that are interested in getting this plant material, they can be guaranteed that this is disease-free material and get off to a better start.
Now, we mentioned Pacific Northwest. That's where we're getting a lot of our hops from now. I assume downy mildew exists out there. Is there something about the climate that makes it harder for this disease to affect the hops?
Yeah, typically it's a moist, humid environment. So that's why we saw the hop industry move to the Pacific Northwest a little more, especially on the eastern side of the Cascade Mountains out there, into Idaho. Oregon is another one where that climate's maybe just a little bit lower in humidity than it is here in Wisconsin. So that's where we've seen the most of the plant material that you order from will come from usually the western states, where they have companies and businesses that are selling plant material, but some of that material is not clean, and again, is they have some diseases and viruses that we don't have, but if we don't want to bring that in here as well. But downy mildew is still a problem. It's not just with hops; it's also on a number of other plants that we grow in our gardens, pumpkins. A lot of our vegetables that we grow can have downy mildew. So what's really changed over the last, over 100 years especially, but we've got better fungicides that can help combat some of these problems, especially with downy mildew and some of the other diseases that will reduce the quality of the hops. So that's where we're starting to see more success with the more recent hop yards being produced here, or hops being produced here in Wisconsin. Is that the production starting out clean, and then some of the better fungicides that we have are helping to keep the quality of the hops up, and that's what some of the local beer craft brewers are looking for.
We're talking about hops with Jerry Clark, agriculture agent at UW Extension in Chippewa County, an ongoing effort to find varieties of hops and clean samples of hops we can grow in the state to serve the needs of the craft beer industry here. Jerry, how many strains or species or whatever they are of hops are we playing with in Wisconsin right now?
Well, typically in the different hop cultivars that we have here in Wisconsin as part of the Clean Hop Project, I think we're looking at 11 of them. We're maybe up to a few more. I know the researchers at UW-Madison are picking up a few different varieties every year, but some of the more popular ones that that most growers are looking at, Cascade is a very popular one. It's a very multi-purpose type of hops, and Cascade can be used in a number of different types of beers, but Cascade is quite popular. Mount Hood, Willamette's, and some of the Hallertauers are some of the older varieties that the university's been looking at. But we've got a number of, I think we're up to about 12 or 15 different varieties that or cultivars that we're looking at in this Clean Hop Project. And most of those are available if growers are interested in growing them. I would just encourage them to contact the plant pathology department at UW-Madison to see if Ruth Genger is the researcher in charge of the program. And see what she has available for plants. We've got them located, the trials or some of these, I guess you could call them trials. A number of growers are evaluating them. We have them in several counties across the state, but a number of private hop producers are actually growing them. They're not just on the research stations.
Is there a part of the state that seems like it could be good hop country?
Well, I think overall, as long as you have a well-drained soil, that's one thing hops don't like to be sitting in water. So as long as you have a well-drained soil, you should be able to grow most of these varieties. I know we've got six of these varieties here in Chippewa County. They've all went overwintered quite well. We'll be going into our second year since second full growing season. And again, most hops don't maybe hit that full production until year three. So we're early in this process, but some of the growers will be going on their third year this year, and we should start to be able to pull some yield data and start to get the quality as well as the persistence of the plants through this project.
And Jerry, I just learned the limits of my knowledge there. So hops, it's not like a grain where you plant them each year. It's a perennial.
It's a perennial, yes. And I guess one thing, you know, you just don't plant these things thinking we're going to harvest them easily. It's a labor-intensive crop. You know, you have to have a trellis that's typically about 20 feet tall. So they'll climb up a string or some kind of rope that you'll hang from a cable that's about 20 feet in the air, and they just grab onto that rope and climb the string or the rope that you have hanging there. So the binds typically will get 20 feet. In most research, the higher you can get your bind, the better your yield's going to be. But, yes, it is a perennial. So we look at some other things we're looking at with the university, working with the soils department down there, is some of the nitrogen recommendations. Most of what we're using right now is out of the Northwest from the universities out there. And we're working with the soils department as well as some of the extension agents around the state to look at what the soil and nutrient recommendations should be for growing hops here in Wisconsin. So we have more local data, more local a localized recommendation than what we're borrowing from out west. So we're looking at a number of different projects with hops since it's kind of had a renaissance period here, and hoping we can provide some good data for the growers out there.
Jerry, want to get a quick word. We've got Andy on the line in Chautauqua, who I guess is participating. Andy, briefly, what's going on?
I wanted to say hi to Jerry. He's actually
been out
to the farm. And we just bought the farm, literally, this past summer, and we're installing our hop yard this spring and summer, and putting plants in the ground this summer. We just met with the extension folks in Madison and had a look at our plants that we're getting from the UW Extension Group.
All right, Andy, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. And briefly, Jerry, if there's another farmer out there who wants to try this out, remind us, who do they get in touch with?
Yes, Dr. Ruth Genger is the plant pathologist at UW-Madison in the plant pathology department. And she would be the one to contact via, I'm sure you can find her, I wish I had her information here a little quicker here for you, but she would be the one to contact regarding email, phone number. Just try to get a hold of Ruth, and she should be able to help you out.
Thanks for joining us. That's Jerry Clark, agriculture agent at UW Extension Chippewa County. The Clean Hop Project is the thing to look up if you're interested.
In the wake of President Trump's controversial ban on immigration from 7 Muslim-majority countries, a number of businesses found themselves embroiled in politics. Whether they wanted to or not, the ride-sharing service Uber, for example, was targeted with protests and cancellations after it was seen as undermining a New York taxi strike.
And a number of other companies have taken active stances in opposition to the president's executive order, including big names like Starbucks and high-tech companies like Google and Apple.
And a number of Super Bowl ads contained overtly political content or more subtle statements about diversity. Dee Warmath joins us now for a look at politics and the business world. She's an assistant professor at UW-Madison School of Human Ecology in the Department of Consumer Science. Dee, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Are you seeing a growing trend in companies doing activism and incorporating political statements into their brand, or is this just something that just seems to be converging all right now?
Well, I think there has been a growing trend, but I don't think it's something that's happened in the past couple of months. We've seen this happening over the past probably 10 years, if not more, where this shift of consumers wanting to find meaning in what they buy and where they buy it has been happening for a long, long time. And I think that what we're seeing in current events is just perhaps a heightening or an acceleration of that trend that's been happening for quite a while.
And explain a little bit about what's behind this. Consumers wanting this activism out of their products, how does that connect?
Well, I don't know if it's out of their products, but I think that consumers recognize the power of the money that they spent. And I think that more and more consumers are beginning to recognize that how and where they spend their money can have major implications for social and political causes that matter to them. And so making those choices with that in mind is something that I think consumers have been wanting to do for a long time. And some of the actions that brands and retailers have taken over the past number of years have allowed consumers to do that more conveniently, more easily.
Is there any particular kind of consumer, perhaps millennials, pushing this trend forward, or is this across the board, people, consumers, finding this kind of advertising appealing?
I think you'll find it across the board, but I think that the key is that it has to be something that particular consumer group cares about. So if you're talking to baby boomers, the cause that will resonate with them may not always be the same cause that would resonate with a Gen X or a millennial. And then even within millennials, it's kind of unfair to talk about them as one monolithic group quite often. There are a lot of different needs and causes that will spur particular millennial groups to action.
Have we seen companies then break down their messages, perhaps of a social conscience, to speak to different groups?
Well, I think the key is really for the company not to necessarily try to control the message, but nowadays it's about companies coming to the table in a community with consumers around an idea. And I think the more important thing for companies to do is not the old way of thinking about how do I control my message with particular groups, but how do I look internally and look at what I do and how I do it, and more importantly, why I do it. So that they can then understand which causes resonate with them as a brand. I think that consumers will respond to that authenticity and that transparency of who I am as they engage with the brand or the retailer.
One of those companies that looked internally for Super Bowl ads, that is Budweiser, it was criticized for ads that touched on things like, you know, immigration and diversity, and perhaps being critical of President Trump. Let's take a listen to this Budweiser ad that depicts the label's co-founder immigrating from Germany in the 1800s.
You don't look like you're from around here.
Warum bist du aus Deutschland?
I want to brew a beer.
Welcome to America.
You don't want it here. Go back home.
So really strong images in this ad. Throughout the ad, you see a young man facing the challenges of being an immigrant and not always feeling welcomed. It should also be noted that Budweiser said that this was not a political statement, but the ad did ruffle feathers for the hashtag Boycott Budweiser to start trending. What do you see in this origin story, and where have you seen it in the past?
Well, I think that what I see in this origin story, regardless of which side of the controversy you come down on, is that it's a brand that looked at themselves to say, where did we come from? What's our story? And how do we then go and tell our story? And perhaps it's someone telling a story with a much bigger platform than an average citizen would have. But this is definitely a story that's true to who they are as a company. So I think you have to, in some ways, respect the authenticity of the story, even if you don't like the message of the story.
And you have some history on these types of stories going back to the early 1900s.
I do. So one of the stories that I love best in retail, and I tell my students all the time, is about James Cash Penny and how when he was a young man, he ended up in Kemmerer, Wyoming. And he knew that he wanted to start some type of business, perhaps a retail business, but didn't exactly know where. He decided to start his business in Kemmerer because he saw the coal mining town with its company store. And when you walked in the door, the store knew how much money you made, therefore it knew how to set the prices so it could keep its the citizens indebted to the store and they could never leave the town, the mining town. Mm. And so he started what was called the Golden Rule Store, which was about a different way of thinking about retail, where it was one price no matter who you were, and it was priced based on the product and what he felt the product was worth in the marketplace. And then I thought it was interesting, you know, his philosophy was consumers should never be indebted to a store. And he was the lone dissenting vote in the 1950s when JCPenney was considering adding a store credit card, because he believed that up until that time that they should not allow their consumers to become indebted to them.
Hmm. And now you can't go anywhere without at the checkout line being asked to get a credit card.
That's right.
Hmm. We're talking with Dee Wormath. She's an assistant professor at UW-Madison School of Human Ecology in the Department of Consumer Science, talking about activism that we're seeing in advertising, trends of being socially conscious. Of these companies. And Dee, there's this old saying that, quote, sex sells. Is that no longer true, or is that just being kind of backburnered right now?
Well, it probably depends on your audience and your product. as to whether it sells or not. I think it would be hard-pressed to say that it does not sell at all, although it would be nice to be able to say it doesn't sell at all. But I do see this rise of being responsible and being involved in ideas and having people who then respect that and want to put their money in those particular settings. And I think it also reflects a shift in the relationship between brands and consumers. In the beginning of the days of the Marlboro Man and Virginia Slims, brands told us how we needed to be. And they said, if you drink my beer, if you smoke my cigarettes, you'll be more of the person you need to be. And then the second version of that was when they wanted a relationship with their consumer. Mr. Clean, helping you clean your house, right? I'm here, I'm your partner. And now it's much more about this we mentality, this community mentality, about the brand and the consumers rallying around an idea together.
Why is this working?
Why is this working?
Yeah, rallying around the brand like this and being more, you know, centered on we versus this is what you should do and this is what you should eat, smoke, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. I think that it's first of all, in retail, we have clearly entered the era of consumer power. So consumers understand that they have choices and where they can go. But I also think that we're in this era of the kinship economy, and the Futures Group, Futures Company in New York talks about that quite often, J. Walter Scott, around how we are we're more collaborative, we're more interested in sharing, we're more interested in what our social media connections have to say than we are perhaps in institutions that prescribe to us who we should be.
And social media has really gone gangbusters with some of the push and pull going on with these political statements. Airbnb and Coca-Cola were also criticized for ads with political themes. Can we expect to see more pushback, especially on social media, against this political trend?
Well, I don't know the answer to that particular question, but I do think that because of the platform of social media, that one of the things that's the responsibility of consumers is to make sure that they're educated. You can't read one post in social media and assume that you understand the story. And I think that we have a responsibility to seek out other sources and reputable sources to be able to come to our own conclusion as to what's really happening.
Why do you think companies are becoming more comfortable sending these types of messages and these types of political statements? I'm thinking to Patagonia closing its stores on Election Day.
Mm-hmm.
What is the comfort level there?
Well, and I think different companies have different levels of comfort with that, and it makes sense for some retail brands more so than others. So I think that you have to understand who you are and whether it would make sense to do that. And then I also think that, again, this is a movement that's been coming for a very long time. And there are a number of agencies out there that have been working with brands and how to do this and how to tap into ideas on the rise. You know, Scott Goodson has a terrific book called Uprising. It was written in 2012 that's all about how to do movement marketing and how to know whether you're ready as a brand to do this and then how to find the right idea to connect. So, again, I think this has been something that's been coming for a while. And some brands like a Patagonia, it makes very much sense that they would be on the leading edge of this. A lot of other brands now, some of them are being forced into it by the extreme scrutiny, and others of them are beginning to come along.
Who might be the ones being forced into it by extreme scrutiny? Any examples there?
Well, I don't know if I have any examples of that, because I don't know if I know enough about the cases to be able to make a claim like that.
We're talking with Dee Wormath. She's an assistant professor in the Consumer Science Department at UW-Madison. We're looking at how activism can be good for business and why companies are taking stances on political and social issues.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about businesses taking stances on political issues, on social issues? What did you think of maybe the more political Super Bowl ads that we saw this time around? When you're shopping, do you consider the political or social impact businesses have, the statements they've made? Have you embraced a business because they've taken a stance? Have you avoided a business because they've taken a stance? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up the conversation with Dee Warmouth. She's an assistant professor in the Consumer Science Department at UW-Madison. We're looking at how activism can be good for business and why corporations are taking stances on controversial issues.
And you can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Do you think businesses should stay out of political issues? What do you think of companies like Starbucks promising to hire refugees or efforts like the Pepsi Refresh Initiative? If a business supports a particular cause, do you think they should be public about it? And when it comes down to it, does it affect how you spend your money? Have you embraced a product line, a company because of a stance they've taken, or have you avoided buying from someone because of that? Call in at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Dee, are companies always considering their bottom line when they make these social statements?
Well, I think at some point they have to, right? Because you can think about what's desirable and what's feasible, but you also have to think about what's viable. If you don't think about your bottom line, sooner or later, you're not going to be there to support. And I think that in some ways, not to equate businesses with consumers, but consumers do the same similar thing, right? Because they're thinking about, I want organic food or I want to do this until they start to think about their budget and how far can they support this. So I think that the best of the companies out there are trying to find some balance, and they're not necessarily engaging in these activities solely for the bottom line, but they are having to think about their bottom line if they want to be able to do this for long.
Let's welcome a call now, Zach from Green Bay. Hi, Zach.
How are you guys doing? Thanks for taking my call. I'd just like to bring up the point of, or the example of Chick-fil-A when they came out against same-sex marriage. I personally have never given any more business to them when they came out against that. I think that, you know, you just brought up that a company needs to consider its bottom line. I totally agree with you that that's, you know, they're not going to get any more business from me because they took this political stance on an issue that I feel strongly about.
Dee, what is the case study on Chick-fil-A and their stance?
Well, I'm not entirely familiar with that, but I do love the process and the thought process that Zach engaged in. I love the fact that he listened to what the company had to say and decided that it was not in line with what he believed, and he made the decision not to buy their food. And I think that I love the fact that we're now shifting back from being pure consumers driven solely by the taste and perhaps price, and also thinking about the citizen side of who we are and voting with our money and our food choices.
Let's take a call now from Tim from Northern Illinois. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What would you like to add?
Yes, I listen to public radio. I'm a Northern Illinois resident, and I think it's inappropriate for business to get involved in political issues unless it's driving, you know, it's in their business interest. And I would boycott businesses that do get involved in issues one way or another, whether I agree with the issue or disagree with the issue. I think it's just inappropriate in a capitalist society.
Dee?
Well, I think that Tim is right in the sense that retailers and businesses can go too far. And again, if they're simply trying to make a statement as opposed to trying to communicate something about who they are, I think there is some gray space in there in terms of, you know, how far a business can go before it's sort of crossed that line.
Before it starts alienating.
Right. Large numbers of consumers, whether they agree with the stance or don't agree with the stance.
Yeah. What would you suggest for someone like Tim who really wants to keep politics out of his choices as what he buys as a consumer?
Well, I think that, first of all, he can vote with his wallet in terms of where he chooses to go. He can also vote by communicating to the company and helping them understand why he made his choice. And companies nowadays listen to what's happening and the messages that they're getting through all different vehicles. So I think that he can express that opinion, and I think that that's a very valid opinion as well.
And are there particular companies that are doing this type of activism particularly well that you talk about in your classes? Are there companies that are really standing apart here?
Well, one of them would be Dove Beauty. Right. So how they had their original campaign. And I think there are a lot of things that we can, that particular people can point to with any campaign where they feel like it's not necessarily done completely well. But I think Dove Beauty has been one where they've tried to celebrate the women's bodies and what real health looks like. And I think that's one good example all the way around.
Dove is also part of a company that Unilever, which is also owns the Axe product, mm-hmm. which runs counter to what Dove is trying to do.
Right.
Is that unusual to have products going in different directions?
I don't think so, because I think that if you look back at the history of Dove and you look at where Dove came from, it's a very different brand from what Axe is. And I've also heard that Axe has been looking for some ways to change its tune lately as well. So perhaps Dove can have an influence on Axe, given that they have the same umbrella company.
Let's take another caller now, Natalie from La Crosse. Hi, Natalie.
Hi there. You guys are actually talking about exactly what I called for, about Dove. That in becoming more aware of my choices, I guess, as a consumer, that I'm actually making the cognitive choice to buy Dove instead of buying something else, is kind of new for me. And I think, I hope a lot of other people are doing the same thing, that are aligned with value in that way.
Yeah, so Natalie, engaged in what you're just talking about with Dove embracing the everyday woman approach in its marketing.
Right, exactly. And then how Natalie then became a part of the community that supports that idea and wants to help that idea build. And Dove being the brand with resources to be able to bring a platform together that she can become a part of.
Natalie, thanks for your call. Let's hear from Dan in Racine. Hi, Dan.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call, guys. I just wanted to say that, in a kind of a brave new world where certain people are tweeting about companies one way or another, it's almost impossible to not take a stance. I think if you hear somebody you agree with tweeting about somebody or some company, you're possibly going to buy that product. And if you hear them tweeting about a company and you disagree with that, you're going to do the exact opposite. At least that's been my experience.
The power of social media as well. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's the power of social media, but it's also the power of consumer choice. If you only had one option and you didn't like what that one option was doing, you'd kind of be stuck with it. But all you have to do is click away to another website or walk a few feet to another store, and you can make those choices now that perhaps you couldn't have made in the past.
Dan, thanks so much for calling in. Let's go to Todd in Milwaukee. Hi, Todd.
Hello.
What would you like to add?
Well, I think times have changed, too, where companies are getting more verbal about their political views. I don't think it's a good thing. I think it's polarizing consumers, where we all used to be just one body of consumers. And since the elections, I won't drink coffee or purchase Starbucks coffee because of some executives who have been very verbal. And I don't think that's a good thing.
How has it changed your life not supporting any products from Starbucks or Pepsi? How have you changed?
It makes me feel good because there's not much I feel I can do, but that's one thing that I can do is direct my dollars.
That's very true, and I think that's a good thing from the process perspective in terms of consumers considering, like you have, Todd, what it is that you believe in, and then looking at the marketplace to say, where can I put my money where it agrees with my own beliefs? And I'm sure there are other people in the world who drink Pepsi and Starbucks because of what those views are.
And as we move forward here, and as you watch these companies and engaging in the social political climate around them that is changing minute by minute, hour by hour, what are you watching for?
I like to look at the stories and say, do I believe them? Do I think that this is something that comes from who they are as a brand? Is it an expression of their history and then their core values? And so I like to look and see whether or not they're being authentic and true to themselves. The ones who are not, the ones who are trying to get caught up in this as a way to make a buck are probably the ones who are going to lose out in the long run.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Mm-hmm.
That was Dee Warmath. She's an assistant professor at UW-Madison's School of Human Ecology in the Department of Consumer Science, joining us to tell us how businesses are using activism to win over customers.
It is, if you hadn't noticed, Valentine's Day. People are celebrating love. Good, that's great. But one new survey caught our eye on the issue of cheating, but not that kind of cheating.
It's TV cheating, specifically streaming services like Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, and others. It's when a couple is watching a series together, maybe binge watching, maybe watching a little bit at a time, and one partner sneaks off and watches more episodes on their own, leaving the couple completely out of sync.
A new survey from Netflix finds that 46% of couples around the world who use that streaming service have people who sneak ahead of their partners on their favorite shows, and here's where it gets bad. Most of those cheaters plan to cheat even more.
And last year, one company released commitment rings that transmitted a signal so that a couple could only watch selected shows when both rings were present. It doesn't seem to have caught on, though.
Yeah, in my household, my wife is usually more wanting to watch TV than I am at any given point. I have other ways to, you know, waste my time. And so she ends up, and I'm okay with it. I let her
You're
run off
okay
ahead. So she just ends up
watching
more series than me. And does the kids will do that, too.
Does she fill you in then? And then are you kind of disappointed?
No. If I really want to, I'll catch up, and she doesn't spoil anything for me. I just don't feel that strongly about it.
So let her get ahead.
No
then.
Problem in our
yeah.
household. Happy Valentine's Day, TV viewers. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.